Opening the show was Warrior Goddess by Lisa Thiel, in honor of one of the goddesses we'll be discussing tonight, Durga, Goddess of Justice, with Laura Amazzoni, author of the book Goddess Durga and Sacred Female Power. Now, that interview is going to be followed by one with Elizabeth Fisher. She's the one who wrote the Rise Up and Call Her Name curriculum. Elizabeth is going to be in the second half of the show. We're going to do an interview titled Lilith Meets the Green Man. Quite interesting stuff with both of these wonderful ladies. So I'm so glad you're with me tonight. Well, wow, what a weekend last weekend was. I attended the anti-war pro-people rally on Sunday in Hollywood. It was an awesome event. There were many blimps going down the street, a big cardboard tank, a dozen draped coffins, signs, and more signs, all about how we need to be spending money on education and jobs and housing and infrastructure and not bullets and bombs, not padding the pockets of the rich. And another wonderful thing about it was the diversity of the crowd, people of so many political affiliations, though I have to say no right-wingers, no Tea Party people, as you might imagine. But the people there were all ages, skin colors, ethnic backgrounds. It was definitely a We the People march, not some phony AstroTurf corporate-funded right-wing Republican agenda march. And, you know, I have to say, although it was a lot of fun, a sad note that, you know, really lingers with me was the Christians that were mocking our peace march from the sidewalks with their bullhorns. They were saying stuff like, "You dirty hippies, you haven't had a bath since the 60s. And, you know, I found that rather incredible because, you know, from my days as being a Catholic and what I know about Jesus, I think Jesus would have been in the peace walk, not shouting at the peace activists from the sidelines. And coming up this weekend, I wanted to tell you I'm headed to the American Academy of Religion being held at Whittier College. I've been honored to have another of my papers accepted by the West Core folks, which I've written, titled The Politics of Eco-Feminist Goddess Spirituality, A Theology for a Sustainable Future, and that theology is with an A. Now, if you can't make it to Whittier College for the conference, where many other wonderful papers will be given, I'll probably have this talk on YouTube in the coming weeks if all goes well, or maybe I'll write some sort of a review for my examiner column. So, you know, stay tuned in all the usual places where, you know, I talk to you about things. And as I promised, I've been doing this since Keith Olbermann left Countdown on MSNBC. In honor of him, who we know will be back on the air in June as the news director on Al Gore's current TV, I will ask the question he would have asked every night. And that question is, "Hey, Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters, but all you and your party seem to be working on are cultural wars, redefining rape, trying to take the rights of women to their bodies away from them. All your party seems to be doing is taking rights away from workers and women. It feels like a war you're waging against us. So what's next? Have you figured out a way to privatize the air we breathe? Maybe the way you'll do it is to sell us respirators after you defund the EPA. Well, you know, everyone isn't sleeping, Mr. Boehner. Everyone isn't being duped by the propaganda coming out of Fox News. And a bit more housekeeping before we get to tonight's first guest, Laura Amazzoni, author of Goddess Durga and the Sacred Female Power. Some new developments I want to just tell you about real quickly. You may have heard, or maybe not, so I'm telling you now, Blog Talk used to be free to hosts like myself. Well, they no longer give us free airtime. They are charging us about $40 a month, and that's not a lot yet, but we are looking for a sponsor to help keep us on the air, to keep the show funded. And, you know, I'm hoping that if you like Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you will help support us, because we know, like Goddess teaches, what you tend, what you nurture, what is nourished, well, it thrives, and what you neglect, it withers. And thanks to those of you who have already sent in some contributions to the cost of the show. You can make a donation of any amount you can afford. You can go to the Goddess Store page of my website. There are PayPal buttons there. And I don't care if it's $5 or $10, you know, it all adds up. So whatever you can do is most appreciated, especially in today's economy. And while you're there at my website or on the Blog Talk show page of mine, be sure to remember the three F's that I try to remember to tell you about every week. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, be sure to become our friend. And maybe most important of all, you want to click that follow button. That way, you will never miss notice of my new guests each week. In case you don't get an email, or maybe you, you know, didn't see the email, that way you're a part of our growing family of listeners, and you're always in the loop of who's going to be on the show every week. And I want to make sure you know about the tour I'm leading to Turkey in November. Turkey, land of the nourishing mothers, used to be called Anatolia. I'm going to be taking both men and women on the trip for 2 weeks. We're going to go to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Şatıl Hayık, Side, Lagina. And I bet you didn't know, Lagina is where we find Hecate's only known standing temple that modern man has laid eyes on, and modern woman. You know, we're going to do activities like dream incubations. We're going to do rituals at the site, because every time I go there, we're there by ourselves for the most part. We're going to do Turkish baths. There are also these mineral springs near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias that we're going to, you know, go to like a healing center almost. So anyway, if you feel like you're hearing the call for a sacred journey, whether you want to satisfy your mind or your body or your soul, go to my website, KarenTate.com. People are signing up. We're only going to take 20 people. So go there, look at the itinerary. There's also a video that shows some glimpses of our last trip to give you a sense of what we did and what the place looks like. So anyway, don't delay if you think you might really want to go. And, you know, some of you have emailed me and said, you know, you rarely talk about your own books. And that's true. I kind of don't use the show to hype my own books. But in this case, I am going to go ahead and take just a second here. While you're at my website, KarenTate.com, yes, I have written 2 books. The first was Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and the second one was Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. The first tells you how to get to these sacred places around the globe if you're a traveler, but also, or maybe even more important, if you're an armchair tourist. Many reviews have said that people feel like the book takes them there. And as far as the other book, Walking an Ancient Path, well, it was a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. I guess you could call it sort of a spiritual and socio-political look at embracing goddess, deity, archetype, or ideal into your life and community. You know, there's lots of rituals, meditations, politics, how to do things in there, How to Look at Goddess tells you why she's still so relevant today. And both books are $25 plus shipping and handling. And so think about it. You can get those special prices on my website. And there's also free stuff on the website, especially with spring equinox. We're in that season. There is actually a wonderful spring meditation there that you can download that talks about, within the meditation, all the pagan dying and rising gods sitting there at the knee of Goddess. And at the end of the meditation, well, all of their different faces morph into that of Jesus, you know, referencing the pagan roots of Christianity and how we might find common ground with our progressive Christian friends. So take a look. And I also have a new article out that's published in the international magazine called La Luz, and it's titled The Inhumanity of the GOP, Always for Profits, Not People. I think there's probably a link to it on my website, but if not, check out La Luz magazine, L-A-L-L-O-U-Z. And if you're listening live and want to call in and talk to one of my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see your number pop up on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation and invite you to give your comment or question. I'll identify you by your area code. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show. Many of you have emailed me saying how much you like this opening, so I will repeat it. And it goes like this. As many of you know, our patriarchal world and monotheistic religions, adversaries of the sacred feminine, tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, well, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed. It became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on the show I'm dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, here we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are today, and we understand how they've come to be turned on their head and so unnatural. And you know what? We are going about setting things right. Why? Well, because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, it's women armed with our like-minded brothers and ideals of the sacred feminine who will set things back on course. And I think we are. From every nook and cranny across the globe, what you hear out of people's mouths is the sacred feminine is the answer. So let me once again repeat what have become the mottos for the show. The first quote is from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer, and it goes like this. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And the second one, attributed to Gandhi. Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. So let us win the battle of restoring the sacred feminine to the globe. And let's delay no further to start our show because we've got a lot to get to. Let me welcome Laura Amazoni to the show. Laura, are you on the line with me?
Yes, I am. Hello, Karen.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your patience during my intro. Let me start by giving listeners a little bit of background. I'll read your bio here, and then we'll jump in and talk about the Goddess Durga in your book, Goddess Durga and the Sacred Female Power. Well, Laura Amazoni, she is an author, teacher, jewelry artist, and yogini. She completed her master's degree in philosophy and religion with an emphasis in women's spirituality at the California Institute of Integral Studies in 2001. Her book, Goddess Durga and Sacred Female Power, explores the millennia-old rituals and manifestations of the goddess in South Asia and honors female creative and sexual power as a divine force. Laura teaches classes and workshops on goddess spirituality and Eastern religious traditions. She has published numerous articles discussing myth, ritual, adornment, and the significance of South Asian goddesses as divine models of female empowerment. She has received initiation into the Shakta Tantra, Sri Vidya, and Kashmiri Shaivite lineages. Did I get that right?
Kashmiri Shaivite.
Thank you, thank
Close.
You.
I've never actually
heard the word pronounced.
Quite a mouthful, yeah.
Yeah, it is a kind of a foreign word. And Laura, while we're talking about where you teach and what you teach, you're about ready to teach some classes here in the L.A. area, aren't you?
Yes, I'm going to be teaching some more classes, actually, at Loyola Marymount University Extension in the Yoga and Philosophy Program. Beginning in May, I'm going to be teaching a class called Saha, I Am She, Faces of the South Asian Goddess, for 6 weeks. And then at the end of June, for the next six-week session, I'm going to be teaching my Path of the Yogini class. And I also just confirmed today that I'll be teaching a class at Exhale Yoga Studio and Spa in Venice on Main Street. And that's also going to be on Shakti and the goddesses, faces of the goddess. And I'll be at Bhakti Fest at Joshua Tree in a couple weeks, too, doing my Fierce Goddess workshop. So a lot of opportunities to engage with this material if you're here in Southern California.
Wonderful. Well, and I know you work full time, so in here you've just written this book and you're teaching all of these classes. You must be exhausted.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot of Shakti. I'm sometimes exhausted, but I have a lot of Shakti from
well,
working
good.
With this material. A lot of energy, yeah,
well,
which is a blessing.
Well, you know, Laura, I know we're going to talk about the goddesses, and we're going to explore the many faces of Durga and how and why they're useful to women today. But maybe just briefly, you know, in case listeners don't remember from the last time I had you on the show, give us just a little bit of background about how you came to have this passion, you know, for Durga and the goddesses of this part of the world.
Sure. Actually, I've always been interested in spirituality ever since I was a child and kind of mystical traditions, and always felt this presence of a divine force, which I consider to be female. And essentially, my background, my upbringing was very difficult, very challenging. I come from a history of pretty severe abuse. And so that kind of set me on this quest when I was in my 20s, looking for some sort of role models of power. And at the same time, my own body was breaking down, and I had experienced many debilitating illnesses, especially gynecological illnesses, endometriosis, which is a menstrual disorder. And again, I just wasn't sure what was happening, and really what it was my body crying out for me to heal from what had happened when I was a child, and to reclaim my power and really look at the roots of that oppression that I had suffered from. And so it just sent me on this quest looking into different traditions, and I found myself in Southeast Asia and actually did not even want to go to South Asia, but had many mystical experiences and encounters where people would just approach me and assume that I'd already been to Nepal. And this happened so frequently that I decided that it was a calling, that I needed to go there, and found myself there at the Temple of the Kumari, who I believe I spoke about the last time, who is a young girl who is worshipped as an embodiment of the goddess Durga, one of the forms of the goddess Durga. And she's actually the goddess that women with menstrual disorders go to. And so that kind of started this whole quest and study. It brought me back to the United States. I'd been living abroad for about 6.5 years, brought me to San Francisco to study at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and I decided to write my master's thesis on Durga. And as I started reading about her myth, I realized this was the story of my life, that I had been battling these demons, internal demons and external demons, like Durga battles in this epic narrative.
Okay.
So, and it just is something that my whole life has kind of become devoted to her and her various manifestations, and just experiencing her expression in so many aspects of my life, in past and present. And so I just knew it was my dharma to write this book. And
so you're not just a scholar of Durga, you're a practitioner as well.
I'm a practitioner as well, yes.
Absolutely.
But I love the knowledge, I love the information, and I love
sharing
it. Well,
now Durga,
it, so.
I know some people get Durga and Kali confused. Kali is the one that comes forth out of Durga's head. Do I have it right this time?
Yes, according to the Devi Mahatmya myth, but depending on where, which region of India, you're referring to the Divine Mother. Essentially, they're one and the same goddess. Their mythology is a little different, but you could consider Durga to be kind of this aspect of fierce compassion. She's known as an invincible goddess, an unassailable goddess, a goddess of strength and justice. And Kali is a goddess of transformation and power, but also specifically death and destruction. And sometimes she's described as being more that quality by Western feminists, especially of righteous rage.
Righteous rage. Well, Durga and Kali sound a lot to me like the way I view the goddess Sekhmet: righteous anger, empowerment, transformation, justice.
Absolutely.
That sort of thing. Now, we always see Durga, well, I shouldn't say always, but I've all seen Durga a lot, riding on or flanked by lions.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, we see a lot of these, ancient goddesses of the ancient world with their connection to their feline companions. And I think it speaks to our instinctual nature really connecting back to that ancient wisdom, embodied wisdom of the feline and the regalness of these great cats. And it's her vehicle, it's her power, kind of her power animal or totem, it would be referred to in some traditions,
mm-hmm.
that she rides into her great battle, but it's kind of inseparable from her.
Right, right. Well, now we're going to talk about Durga and seven different aspects of her. You've got Durga, goddess of justice. You've got the Bhagavati.
Mm-hmm.
Bhagavati, Sarasvati, Lakshmi, the Yogini, the Matrikas, and nine Durgas, and then finally Kali.
Mm-hmm.
So we have probably about 40 minutes or so. So let's start at the top. I mean, you've already said a bit about Durga, goddess of justice. What more should we know about her and why she's useful to men and women today?
I think she's just a really important model for these times, because she's also known as the remover of fear and the remover of difficulty. And as we learn from her myth, when she comes to fight this battle, there's actually three sets of battles that are described in the story. And she comes because the male gods have been unsuccessful in defeating these demons. And the demons are destroying the precious equilibrium of all the worlds, actually. And so it's only the supreme wisdom of the mother goddess that can come and restore balance, restore harmony to all the worlds. And I think she's a really fitting guide considering what's happening in these times. And she's here also to remind us that, these natural catastrophes that occur, or the death, the sickness, all of these things that are not man-made, and even those that are, she's here to teach us about an approach where we can find a sense of inner peace, we can find just a sense of equilibrium within.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm thinking, Laura, and tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm trying to connect the dots here, because I think it's so important that we don't look at these goddesses as just mythology, as just something that people thought about a long time ago. I mean, even though, I mean, obviously in India, they've never forgotten the goddess, but, I guess I look at, you said goddess, she removes fear, I think
mm-hmm.
you said.
Yeah,
when I think about what's going on out there in the world, how much much of it, when you really get down to the core, is about fear. Fear of not having enough natural resources, fear that those natural resources are in another part of the world and not here, so we need to use bullets and bombs to control it.
Right.
Fear of somebody's other religion that's not like mine. Just fear, fear, fear. I mean,
yeah.
It seems like we are totally in fear as a species, and if we had less fear and more faith, I guess I just wonder if the military-industrial complex would have a business.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder that too. Yeah, and I think it's really a fear. It's speaking to our sense of alienation and our sense of separation too, and this whole, this othering, us versus them, but really not understanding that we are all connected. We're all connected,
mm-hmm.
By love and by our connection to the divine, regardless of whatever name we are going to give the divinity.
Right.
But in these teachings, specifically the tantric teachings around Durga, they're not about, what we hear in California talk, some of people refer to Tantra as this whole system referring to sexual practices and so forth. That is absolutely not it. It's really about confronting adversity and embracing paradox and finding the unity behind diversity, behind our differences, and also honoring the differences within that sense of unity.
Mm-hmm. So it's like finding common ground with other people, respecting our differences, but yet still being able to stand under the same umbrella kind of a thing.
Exactly, exactly. And just if we can remember in these moments, and it is a practice, I know, even for myself, feeling so connected to her, but I know in this past week, just the amount of suffering, just knowing that people in Japan are experiencing, or in Libya, it's been heartbreaking to me. People,
mm-hmm.
animals, just everything, just the repercussions of what is happening. And I just feel that we need to turn to this wisdom of Durga and really find that place of calm within our hearts. And if it's just by focusing on our breath, then we focus on our breath, and just do things that we can, calm ourselves, calm our minds particularly, because we're being fed so much from the media around what's happening. It's no wonder everyone is stressed out and freaked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I was thinking myself the other day, because with everything going on in the world and some personal stuff that happened to pop up out of the blue that had me, kind of angst-ridden, and I mean, you may have, you started to talk about, breathing as a technique. If I could sort of just shove aside the fear and let that not be a part of me and just sort of connect into my center, I could find a little glimmer, a glimmer of, it's all going to be okay. You don't have to get yourself all worked up about this. It really is going to be okay. And is that
and okay may look like something
about?
Different than what we have in mind. I'm sorry. Yeah. That, I think it's important for us not to have, just to be open to the possibility that something that is okay in our mind may not be how things unfold, but ultimately, yes, I agree that it will be okay.
Yeah. Now, did you want to go on to the Bhagavati, or did you want to tell us more about Durga, goddess of justice?
Sure, I can tell. I mean, essentially what all these different goddesses are just different faces of her, that she is the one and the many. And so Bhagavati, Sarasvati, all these different goddesses really express different aspects of her reality, or just of the reality of the universe. And Bhagavati is another name for Durga in Nepal and some parts of India, but it's also another meaning of it is power, yoni, and dazzling light, the word Bhaga itself. And so I've come to refer to her as the She of the Resplendent Yoni. And this is really to honor the goddess as the source, the ultimate source, that we come from her and we return to her.
Mm-hmm.
And just looking at, many other scholars' work on, Miriam Robbins Dexter just published a fabulous book, I'm sure. I think you had her on the show, but it's called Sacred Display.
Yes.
Or even Lucia Birnbaum's work in Dark Mother, where she talks about how the oldest iconic representation of divinity on this planet is a pubic V.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the pubic triangle. And so really considering the yoni or the vagina, the vulva, as a sacred symbol. And I think this is really at the root of these mysteries too, the sacrality of the female body. And again, we look at so much of what's happening in the world, or particularly within Orthodox religions, this need to control our sexuality is so prevalent. And so, again, I find that just being familiar with these, with the mythology around her, the different symbols, the different practices, just gives us, provides a different worldview, different possibilities for us.
Well, yeah. Imagine if, you know, we went into our sacred houses, whatever we would call them, temples, churches, whatever, and up at the front of the structure, we saw a sacred yoni.
Yeah.
I mean, that would put women in a whole different place, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And if we knew what we were looking at, yeah, yeah. Because
well,
there are also the Sheila gigs, right, on the churches in Ireland.
Yes.
But
yes,
I had
absolutely.
Yeah. But they're often not even really noticed. I had a student in one of my classes recently mention that and said, you know, that she wouldn't have even noticed that unless her guide hadn't pointed it out. And so I think we've kind of been trained to not even see, in a sense, there's ways that we don't even notice.
Or maybe even look away because,
yeah,
heaven forbid, that might be taboo or shameful or something like that.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
As if our womb and the birth canal can be something of shame, you know, when it's the life passage.
Well, exactly. And that's what we need to get back to, is honoring this, you know, our womb, our bodies, is this, you know, sacred passage into this world. And even more than that, but it's, yeah, there's just, as we know, there's just so many ways to kind of diminish our power, particularly around our sexuality and our menstruation. And
well, an article just passed my desk today, and forgive me if I'm throwing you a curve here, but we're talking about Nepal, and we're talking about, you know, yonis and, you know, women's sacred bloods and all of that. And still in Nepal, it seems like they have this practice where the women are relegated to the menstrual hut. Did you experience any of that when you were in that part of the world?
I did not, but I did see that article today too. Someone forwarded it to me. Vicki Noble forwarded it, actually. And what I think, what it really said to me, it just reminded me a lot of how the Kumari is one example. The Kumari is this young girl who's chosen to be an incarnation of the goddess Durga, and she's kind of selected, much like a llama is selected and has to go through a series of tests and so forth. And so they say that the goddess will stay in her body until she menstruates, and then the goddess leaves because her menstruation is so polluting or impure. And so there's this whole idea, this whole concept within the Orthodox tradition that there's certain things that are polluting: leftover food, birthing blood, menstrual blood, other bodily fluids. And what this really speaks to in terms of looking at menstruation is just this whole idea of when a young girl comes of age and really comes into her power, she's no longer controllable. She's no longer tameable by the patriarchy. And so, well, I think that, and Judy Gron wrote that wonderful book, Blood, Bread, and Roses, and talks about these seclusion rituals, which I think do have a place, and I think at the root, you know, of these rituals, there's really something to be said about how they can benefit women. But again, these particular practices today have been used to oppress women, fully oppress women.
So they've been distorted under patriarchy.
They've fully been distorted, and especially in this article that we're both talking about today, that these women have died because they've just been banished to these huts and are forced to spend, you know, 10 days there. They're not allowed to touch any of the male members of the family. They're not allowed to look at anyone, and sometimes in the middle of winter, they're left out there with no heating, or in the middle of summer, and so there have been these deaths. And I think this speaks to this fear of female power, female sexual power in particular.
Well, and tell me if, you know, because I might not just understand, I might just be misunderstanding, but with the Kumari, you said when her menses starts, they believe the goddess leaves her body because what was the word you
she's
used?
Impure.
She's impure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that to me sounds very patriarchal.
I can't imagine
the goddess, you know, I would think the goddess would embrace her blood.
Exactly.
You know?
And I write about this in my book, in my chapter on the Kumare. I absolutely say that, and I say that I fully disagree, that that's not what is happening.
Yeah.
Just this patriarchal inversion.
Okay. So then we've got Sarasvati, goddess of sound, speech, power of the mantra. Also that sort of ties into your jewelry making and everything, right?
Yes, well, because Sarasvati is the goddess of creativity. She's the goddess of wisdom. She's the goddess of inspiration. She's the goddess of the arts. And so essentially, for those that aren't familiar with this tradition and those that maybe are familiar but get confused by all the many goddesses, again, they're just expressing different aspects of reality and different aspects of consciousness, more specifically. And Sarasvati herself being the goddess of the mantra or the word, from this tradition's point of view, she is the word, that it is Sarasvati who is dancing off my tongue. It is the power of Sarasvati. It's her grace. It's allowing you to listen right now, to comprehend our words. And so that, and again, it's this whole idea that the vibration of the word creates the world. It brings the world into manifest form. And so Sarasvati is ultimately a goddess of creative power. She's really the power of the generative force behind all existence. And I find her to be the inspiration. I know in writing, in my teaching, in my jewelry making, and so forth.
Okay.
And in the book, too, I'm looking at her mythology again and also exploring how she kind of has... How should I say this? It seems to me like she's kind of had her wings clipped, that we don't see her in her full power as we know her today. That, yes, she is worshipped as this goddess of wisdom, but there's this whole other level, I feel, that has been repressed and denied, and especially considering the connection between our creative power and our sexual power, because she's not even has no sexuality about her whatsoever. And so, and the myth too, one of her myths does point to how her father, Brahma, it's kind of a disturbing tale of how he had tried to force her into wedlock, and she flees and ultimately becomes estranged from her father and would have been husband, but chooses this autonomous path. And so rather than looking upon women who take such an independent, autonomous path, specifically women as artists who prefer to spend time on their own tending to their art. Yeah, I really explore this in the book and how this is Sarasvati's nature.
You reminded me of something as I was listening to you talk about that. She escapes because she doesn't want to get married, and she's autonomous. That sort of brings me to something. I think it might have been you who taught me about this in one of your classes. I have always been perplexed, and maybe we can talk about this again for the sake of the listeners. Maybe they've had the same perplexed confusion that I did. I look at India and I think, okay, there they have never forgotten their goddess, but look how women are still oppressed. Look how the people are still downtrodden and oppressed. And
right.
I'm thinking to myself, why, is this not, a good example of, why isn't women's roles more uplifted? Why don't the people have a better life after all if they're honoring the goddess? Because I would imagine somebody who wasn't a goddess advocate would point to India and go, look, well, they got their goddess. She isn't helping them. But what I think you were teaching me is it's something about the spousification or the domestication of the Hindu goddesses. And
yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
Exactly. I think that's part of the problem, and I think also just, these later Orthodox traditions. What I'm looking at in my book is really the roots, the ancient roots of this tradition, and the Shakta tradition, and going back even earlier. And I do rely on different feminist Indian scholars' works, too. And so, yeah, it's a very relevant question. It's difficult to say, yeah. I don't know.
So, but explain what spousification is.
So spousification is these goddesses, for example, the goddess Lakshmi, who's a goddess of abundance. She's a goddess of harmony. She's a goddess who rules over vegetation. What we don't know about Lakshmi and that in her earlier form, she has this whole other history where she was the lover of other gods. But instead, we find her the most dominant mythology and kind of how she's upheld to be this ideal is in her marriage to Vishnu. And in this marriage, she becomes this ideal submissive wife that she, and she's often depicted as kind of nagging her husband or jealous of the goddess Sarasvati, for example. And so this is, just one way, you know, to kind of keep women in line. So by using the divinity, their divine couple, to kind of portray this idealized model of marriage and couplehood. And so I'm looking, too, at this tradition that, you know, most likely evolved from a more matriarchal culture, possibly where there wasn't the institution of marriage, before the 2nd century CE, before the laws of Manu. I mean, a lot of it is relying on the iconography and, you know, the script of the Indus Valley Civilization, which dates back to 3700 BCE and contains so many goddess figurines, female figurines, and seems to be a very sophisticated, highly creative culture. We don't know, but it just seems to speak to a older tradition where women had at least equal power and women, you know, the female was revered as divine.
So in a way, I think what you're saying, what patriarchy did the Hindu goddesses, in a way is what Christianity does Mary. They sort of set them up as this controllable, passive female
mm-hmm.
that nobody's afraid of, and
mm-hmm.
they want women to aspire to be like them
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, maybe their more natural, autonomous nature.
Right, exactly. And what's interesting is like a goddess like Kali, though, that she, even though she is described as, you know, and depicted in union with her beloved Shiva, but she has not lost her autonomous nature. And I think it's in part because of the territory that she's said to govern, the specifically death and destruction and decay. I mean, yes, she is an everything goddess. She is unconditional love. She is bliss. But really, because her powers haven't been eclipsed in the ways that Saraswati or Lakshmi or just even some of the other goddesses have been set up, because she rules over this very elemental inherent force, you know, within the natural cycle. And I think that's something interesting to consider as well.
Well, could it be that, you know, people don't want to look at death, and maybe so consequently they sort of, they don't covet that domain, so to speak? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Or just that she couldn't be completely suppressed, like her power couldn't be completely denied or couldn't be completely pushed aside, because it is a very real aspect of the cycle. And I think what's different, what I have found personally that's different when I've traveled in India, in Nepal, is that death is very much out in the open. You can go to Varanasi and see them burning bodies at the god. It's something that's, I think, is a little bit more, not a little bit, there's more fear and it's more of a taboo here in the West. But yes, I don't know. It's another interesting question, kind of a mystery, but Kali definitely is a great force.
And so now Lakshmi, we've referred to her a little bit. Let's
mm-hmm.
talk about that face of Durga.
So again, she is the goddess of the vegetative force. We can consider her the goddess of abundance. She's a goddess of material abundance, spiritual abundance. She's a goddess of harmony, again, a goddess of love. And originally, she was a goddess of the marketplace. She was a goddess of commerce. And this is another way that we see later with her domestication, just being spousified, and through her marriage to Vishnu, she kind of loses control over that reign. But, you know, one of the earlier forms of money, the cowrie shell, is one of Lakshmi's symbols.
Mm,
and also is a symbol of the vulva.
Yeah. The
female
vulva
section.
Now, I think I remember, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I don't care. I think when I was writing my book on sacred places and I got to India and I was looking for temples of Lakshmi. I don't think there are many temples of Lakshmi, are there? But yet her image is maybe on banks. Am I remembering that properly?
Yeah, I think you are. I mean, there's the what comes to mind, one Lakshmi temple in Bhaktapur, Nepal, in the Kathmandu Valley. It's actually right near one of the main, near the main square, near Durbar Square, but you cannot enter the temple. Actually, they store grain in that temple.
Mm. Yeah, and I remember her being associated with rice.
Yes,
as well,
and she
just
is,
like
yes.
Demeter is wheat. And
yes, exactly. And she's and also like Ceres. Another one of Lakshmi's names is Shri. That's an epithet that kind of denotes her, this aspect of auspiciousness and royalty and goodness and blessings. And so she's referred to as Shri. And she is the harvest. She is the field. And we have Ceres, the Roman goddess of grain. We get the word cereal. Cereal is
mm-hmm.
from Ceres. And so again, yes, she's connected to Demeter, Ceres, and other goddesses like that.
Right. Then you've got the Yogini, priestess of erotic arts and spiritual power. I remember reading about a place in India, I think it was a place of the 60 Yoginis, Chasuth, something like that.
Oh, the Chasuth, yeah, Yogini Temple in Hirapur, the 64 Yogini Temple. Yeah, actually there's... I'm not exactly sure about the number right now, but probably around between 8 to 12 existing yogini temples in India right now. And I think the yogini is a really important model for us because she is a practitioner. She's an attendant of goddess. She is goddess herself. And there's actually all these different categories of what a yogini is. There's yoginis that are related to astrology. There's yoginis that are related to the chakras. And I explore this specifically in my Path of the Yogini class. But I think that in this day and age, we really need to consider who she is. This is, again, coming from a unconventional tradition, the tantric tradition, which is a response to the more orthodox tradition in the ways that it was trying to control and kind of oppress others, the caste system and so forth. And so when we really look at the yogini, she's one of pure unconventionality, and she defies societal norms, although she may be a householder and then doing her practices in secret. And I think there's a lot to learn from her.
So were you saying she's sort of like the Hindu priestess of the goddess rather than like some contemporary women, who consider themselves goddess clergy, call themselves priestess? In the Hindu tradition, you would call yourself a yogini?
There's another name specifically for priestess, but as a practitioner or as an attendant. But yes, she does kind of have priestess qualities as we would, what we consider a priestess.
Okay. Now, wasn't there something with, I might have this totally confused, but something with Soma, that elusive elixir that everybody was trying to figure out what it was? Did that, and didn't it give immortality or trance-inducing or something like that? I can't remember exactly, but somehow I'm thinking that's connected to the yogini.
I'm not exactly sure if it's directly connected to her. It comes from the Vedas, but this whole idea of the five M's or these five forbidden substances that are described in the left-handed path of Tantra. So you have the left-handed and the right-handed path, and the left-handed is definitely the path that's more unconventional. And these five M's consist of, I'll say the names in English, a fish is one of them, wine, so the sexual ritual, a grain, which could be the soma, and there's one more that is escaping me right now. But that is part of these practices, too, are about understanding that everything is ultimately divine, that nothing is separate from goddess herself. And so how can we consider anything to be polluting? And so we don't know. The yogini, some of the practices... through these practices, through the discipline of their practices, they can acquire what are called siddhis or powers. And some of these powers are like the ability to astral travel, or the ability to become very, very tiny, or the ability to expand and become larger than the universe. And who knows, it's really, Tantra is a path of working with our consciousness and expanding our consciousness. And, you know, perhaps they were using substances like soma or who knows what else to be achieving these states. But ultimately, on this path, it's important to remember for a practitioner, a yogini or a yogi engaging in these rites, to not be, distracted by these supernatural powers, that they serve as distractions to keep us from the goal. And the goal is ultimately to achieve union with the divine, to achieve this non-dual state of consciousness, and really to embrace the divinity within and around us, and to not experience ourselves as separate.
Okay. Yeah, because I do recall that the yoginis were supposed to have supernatural powers, maybe even being able to bring people back from the dead.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's lists and lists of all the powers that they have. So,
now,
and I think it
believe...
also speaks to, again, our consciousness, though. I mean, these are practices working with different levels of consciousness, and we've totally lost touch with that here in this reality, unless, you know, we're using substances. And I think there's much to be said about these traditions that honor the, and these practices that honor the earth. They honor specifically the female body's cycle, the menstrual cycle with the lunar cycle, and just that connection. So a lot of power to be reclaimed and rediscovered through exploring.
So do you think contemporary yoginis can still achieve these states of supernatural powers? Or we've lost that?
No, I think absolutely, absolutely. But it depends on where, and I don't think these are practices that anyone just dives into. I think it definitely requires a guide, someone who's really steeped in the tradition. It's possible, but these are also secret teachings too, so there hasn't been that much material published. There are definitely a few sources that are wonderful.
So you have to, and who would you recommend?
One basic place, you know, kind of the text on this is Vijayadeheji's Yogini Cults and Temples. I think it's kind of difficult to find. That would be one place. Even looking at my chapter on the Yogini in my book, Goddess Durga, Sacred Female Power,
okay.
I talk about all of this and the different powers and all of, and why she is a useful model, I think, what she has to offer us in this day and age, and how we can apply these teachings to our lives here in the West in a reverent way without appropriating these traditions. Because I feel
and we
very
can get
important.
Your book on Amazon?
Yes, you can get my book on Amazon.com. It's also, if you're in Southern California, it's at the Kathmandu Boutique in Santa Monica. It's also at Exhale in Venice.
Okay. Well, we still have two other aspects to get through. You have the Matrikas and Nine Durgas, and you say that sort of falls in the category of power of women in groups.
Yes.
Can that be negative and positive? Because certainly women in groups isn't always a positive thing.
I know. Absolutely. And that's something that's come up a lot in my classes. But I think I'm looking at them just really, again, here we have this idea of the goddess as the one and the many, that she is, you know, she's Durga, she's Kali, and then she is her form as the eight matrikas, and actually Kali is included as one of the eight matrikas. And they, again, represent these very elemental, natural forces inherent in existence. And the eight matrikas specifically represent the four directions and the intermediary points, and they all have their animal mounts. So, again, they have their vehicle, like you asked at the beginning of our discussion about Durga's tiger. Each of the matrikas has a certain animal that she rides. For example, there's an elephant, there's a Garuda, or this mythological bird, there's a swan. And, again, there's so many ways of approaching these goddesses and really looking at the different animals or different tools and weapons that they use and how they're portrayed in the myth to see how we can access their power. And again, it's referring to very instinctual body-based power. It's nothing, yeah. And the Nine Durgas are just another manifestation of this, you know, these collective forms, just as the yoginis are. And the yoginis appear in groups of 64 or 81, and like, so they're multiples of 8 and 9, and here we have the 8 Matrikas and the 9 Durgas. And 7, 8, and 9 are very important numbers within the Hindu tradition, numerologically speaking.
Well, now, does the fact that you have 7, 8, 9 Matrikas or Durgas, does that somehow coincide with the fact that, you know, that aspect of Durga has something to do with women in groups? Or is, am I making the wrong connection?
I'm confused by your question. I'm not sure if you're making the, I don't think you're necessarily making the wrong connection. Can you ask me, say that again?
Sure. All right, you said that there are, I think, 7, 8, or 9 Matrikas, 7, 8, or 9 Durgas. So you have a group.
Yes.
A group of Matrikas, a group of Durgas. Does that, and you're connecting the Matrikas and the 9 Durgas to the power of women in groups. And I'm trying to see if there's a connection there. Because, you know, they're a group of Matrikas or a group of Durgas. Does that also lend power to women in groups?
I think it's definitely possible because it speaks to this whole idea of how, of working within a, you know, for group consensus, like following a more matriarchal model, and that everyone has something to offer, and that each of these matrikas are not separate from Durga. It doesn't matter if there's 7, if there's 8 or 9, they're just a different expression. And so when we gather in groups too, that we each have something different to offer and that each contributes to the whole, but there's always that they're all connected ultimately to this central force of Durga. So does that answer your question?
Well, it makes me, you know, I'm always trying to go back to how is it relevant today, and it makes me think about the Dalai Lama saying it would be Western women who would save the world, and that sort of makes me think of the power of women in groups.
Yeah, absolutely, and even think of the 13 indigenous grandmothers, too.
Yes.
There's a model of, you know, women, 13 women that have come together and from their different traditions and are each are offering something to the conversation. And I think that is a wonderful way, a wonderful approach in helping us find alternative solutions to any of the political, economic, environmental crises on this planet.
And we have one last goddess to get through, and my other guest has not popped up on the switchboard yet. So let's go ahead and, you know, get to Kali, goddess of transformation.
Sure. Maybe I'll read a little bit about from Kali from my book. How about that? So again, Kali is this goddess of tremendous power. And I say, Kali is at home outside the moral order and is not restrained by societal expectations and demands. Whether we are faced with the reality of our own deaths or that of a loved one, Kali strips away the illusions we have held about ourselves and our individual place in this world, forcing us to come to terms with the inevitability of death. These are obviously not pleasant lessons, and yet at the root of our suffering is a deep need for us to surrender to her. There's ultimately nothing we can do to stop death, sickness, aging, natural catastrophes, etc. Kali reminds us we do not have control over such realms of experience. She asks us to let go of our ideas of how things, quote-unquote, should be, and through our acceptance we may experience the deep, loving compassion of this dark goddess.
Mm.
Kali is not merely a goddess of death. She's a goddess of death, birth, and transformation. She is Ma, the all-nurturing and blissful mother. Dark like the earth and black like the night sky, Ma Kali contains all the mysteries of existence in her universal body. Her darkness contains the great mystery of the unknown. We fear the dark goddess only because we cannot control the domains that she governs. When we resist or hold on to certain attachments, she comes with her sword of discriminating wisdom and slices through our delusion. Her lessons may feel severe to our ego minds, but ultimately she comes to free us from all the limitations and conditioning that society and we ourselves have imposed on us. Perhaps Kali has kept her edge and her uncontrollable wild spirit because she embodies a very real, inevitable, and undeniable aspect of existence, namely death, destruction, and decay.
So would you say Kali is probably a goddess that some people are maybe afraid to get to know?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
She's a formidable force. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I found that with Sekhmet, too, you know, that people tend to shy away. But maybe Kali even more so because of what you just read, you know, the idea that you don't really have control, and we like to have that illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like you said, you know, she's the goddess of death and destruction and transformation, and changing is scary.
Absolutely. And it's inevitable, too. So
yeah. So it's so important today, because if we would come to this understanding, then we wouldn't come full circle. Then we wouldn't live in so much fear.
Exactly. And yeah, and even if the fear is there, because I definitely still have my own fear that I have to confront. But there's a way that we can confront it and embrace it rather than denying it or running from it or trying, you know, to avoid it through whatever means, that just to realize that these things are just, a part of life, and try to work with this flow rather than against it.
Right. Well, Laura, I see my Liz Fisher is on the switchboard now. And,
Wonderful. I look forward to listening to Liz. Yeah.
Okay. And so it's 7 o'clock. I want to thank you. And please, thank you for your time. And I want to give the title of your book again. It's Goddess Durga and the Sacred Female Power. And if you would quickly say again where your classes are going to be, because, listeners, I've taken some of her classes. If you're in Southern California, you want to try to take these.
Well, thank you, Karen. They're going to be at Loyola Marymount University in the Yoga and Philosophy Extension Program. I have 2 coming up, and also Exhale in Venice Yoga Studio. And you can check my website, which is lauraamazzoni.com, and my last name is spelled AmazzoNe.
And beautiful jewelry, incredible jewelry. I mean, not just your standard run-of-the-mill stuff. I mean, very unique. I mean, I can see where Lakshmi or Sarasvati
both
are probably working through you.
Exactly. That's what I say. It's all their grace working through me, and I create each piece in a ritual to one of the goddesses, whoever I'm devoting the piece to. So it's all created in a ritual space, just honoring her as a source of all existence. So,
well, Laura, thank you so much, and good luck with
your classes, Karen.
And good luck with your book sales. Whenever I have a question about Hindu goddesses, I always think about contacting you.
Well, anytime. Please do, and hopefully I can answer. So thank you so much. It's been wonderful talking to you again, and have a great time this weekend at the conference.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Blessings and Jai Ma.
Same to you, Laura. Thank you. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, a hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking. Some call it the feminine consciousness. And whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, we talk about here how these new values, how these new ideas, these new benchmarks, which really aren't that new, where they're just resurging again, might save the world. And you've been listening to Laura Amazzoni, author of the book Goddess Durga and the Sacred Female Power. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show, and I'm going to take a very, very brief 1-minute music break to get ready for my next guest, Liz Fisher. She is the author of the Rise Up and Call Her Name curriculum, and I think we have a really interesting show for you tonight. We're going to discuss Lilith meets the Green Man, and I think we're going to probably say some things you haven't heard before. So please, don't go away. I'm going to let you for a minute listen to Zingaya and this little snippet of one of a favorite piece of mine that they do called Breath of Passion.
Thank you.
you, but when I hear that music, it just sort of takes me to a different place. I imagine I am on the back of a camel, and I'm covered in veils, and I am just, you know, just moving to the gait of that camel as it crosses the desert. I can't help it. That's where I go when I hear that song. Maybe a past life in Egypt or something like that. But anyway, first I see Liz is there waiting for me. So let me unmute her and say hello.
Yes. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Hi, Liz. Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Oh, this is great. This is great. I just finished listening to the first part of your show.
Oh,
and it was a wonderful description of all of the various faces of the Indian goddesses, and I was impressed and moved by all of that.
Well, good. I'm so glad. I mean, because that's high praise coming from you. Thank you so much. Well, you know, let me start off by, you know, in case listeners didn't, hear our last interview when you were on the show last year talking about the Rise Up and Call Her Name curriculum, let me, you know, just sort of introduce you to them by way of your bio, and then
okay.
we'll start into our conversation, which I think is really going to be interesting tonight.
Okay.
So Liz, Elizabeth Fisher, she designed, wrote, and edited two multimedia experiential programs, Rise Up and Call Her Name, A Woman-Honoring Journey into Global Earth-Based Spiritualities, and Gender Justice, Women's Rights or Human Rights. Used by thousands of small groups over the last 15 years, these programs intertwine spiritual philosophies and practices with advocacy for social justice, a major thread in Liz's life and work. Rise Up relies on collaboration with contributors from diverse racial and cultural backgrounds, as well as extensive research. The use of myths and storytelling is a major tool for transformation explored in this experiential journey. Preparation for gender justice included attendance at the 1995 Fourth UN World Conference on Women in China and many follow-up events. Liz worked professionally for a decade as an acquisitions editor for major publishing houses, concentrating on popular education regarding computers, engineering, and interior design. She's also been employed in psychiatric social work and law-related positions. She has a degree in psychology from the University of Michigan and a certificate in publishing from the University of California. She's a leader in the women in religion movement, participating over many years in numerous forums and workshops focused on feminist theology and women's issues. And, you know, Liz, I know we're going to talk about Lilith and the Green Man, but I just want to take a minute to tell listeners how important that curriculum, Rise Up and Call Her Name, really is. You know, if they haven't heard about it before, you know, maybe they're youngsters to this, or maybe not even, I would really recommend you go to the website, www.riseupandcallhername. It's such a wonderful place to start if you don't want to read 50 books on, you know, on feminism and goddess spirituality and comparative religions and earth-based spirituality. It's sort of so much is all right there.
Yeah, I when I developed that that piece, I had really been interested for a lot of years in various aspects of feminist theology, but for my own personal development. But when I started to develop the course, I wanted to have it as a journey around the globe. So it required looking into a lot of different traditions and trying to find the woman-honoring mythology within those traditions and use those as a centerpiece for each of the 13 sessions that are included in this course, and tie them also into other aspects of our own personal journeys, so that we would come out of that as transformed and able to apply them in our own lives. So it was a complex undertaking, but it was also very empowering for me, because I was able to interact with a lot of different women and men about their whole view of these subjects and how they related to their heritage. And I specifically chose people who may not be goddess scholars, but who responded to the mythology, or how did it relate to them. And so we wove all of that together into these sessions, and they're run as small groups in communities, and they've been very I think they've had a lot of impact on individuals in the sense that mythology has affected how they can live their lives. Mythology that they may never have heard of before, especially ones that focus on strong female presences. So that kind of ties into what led me to Lilith Meets the Green Man.
Okay. Well, and one final closing comment on Rise Up and Call Her Name. I think a good companion piece to it is the other curriculum,
yes.
Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. And I don't think people always get the idea that myths create our society. And when we lost all the myths about the empowered women and the women leadership, that's what allowed the patriarchy to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to recreate. We just need to reclaim the ancient myths we already have in place, to sort of reestablish the balance. So do you think that's a good way to describe it?
I think so. I think also when we discover these stories or have an experience of them, we can also relate them to what is happening in our lives and what's happening in the society and how the society is really controlled by myths, even though they're not called out as much as maybe these other cultures labeled these stories. There are certain myths within our culture that we may not realize how much effect they have, even on the secular culture. And one of those is the Garden of Eden myth, which we're going to get into a little bit tonight. And those are kind of controlling myths. And there are several others that come from some of the monotheistic sacred books that are not very compatible with women honoring tradition and women honoring practices. So by having these other myths that we can be exposed to and also reflect on, we can change our own psychology and then start to find ways to act in the culture that would be different and more empowering. At least that's one of my objectives and one of the things I've experienced from the myths myself.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, really, patriarchy relies on religion. It's sort of a linchpin for injustice. And I really think that by changing our myths, looking at these other myths, examining them like we're going to do tonight, Lilith, the Green Man, the Garden of Eden, we start to see how they have controlled our culture.
Well, that's what I discovered, and then when I started to discover other myths, where some of these images that are in the patriarchal myths were almost the exact opposite in meaning, I began to see what the social, what the goal of some of these patriarchal myths actually was. And I think
that's why
when you look at the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, which you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and other programs, but that one in particular is the first one that I was involved with in teaching and at the very beginning, actually, when it was being developed and before it was published, I actually met Shirley Rank, who was the author. And so I felt like I was really being given something fresh in the dominant culture that I had only read about in some obscure books at that point in the beginning of the 1980s. And now there's so much more known and so many more people are putting out these wonderful resources. So I think we've come a long way in bringing out other mythology and working with it in our own personal lives and in our communities.
Well, you know what? Well, let's jump in then. We maybe sort of touched on it, but was there more you maybe wanted to say about why mythologies are so important in our lives today?
Well, I think I kind of covered some of the feeling I have about it, but I would say that the idea of myth in earth-based or earth-centered traditions is really a sacred story. And in our culture, we have equated myth with falsehood. So it's really important to understand how these two might be, how we might use them, because often we hear that, oh, that's just a myth or that's fiction. And actually, it kind of denigrates the whole role of the sacred story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I've tried to bring up in the work that I do, is that we need to look at a myth and fiction as a different cultural form, and it's a form that is often related to the concept of a medicine story. It's a story that we tell ourselves, our societies, our groups, that teaches some sort of lesson that we want to impart or that we want to incorporate in our own lives. So that was one of the things I wanted to say about myth and why I love to work with the mythology. But there is so many different types of mythology. So you have to make your choices, in my view. And you have to, every culture seems to have a strong patriarchal overlay, is what we ended up calling it. And, you know, taking that patriarchal overlay off and really reclaiming, reforming a kind, a more life-honoring, woman-honoring, egalitarian version of it is what, what I have always advocated for.
Well, and how does one mythology, namely the stories in the Bible, how does that become the Word of God, air quotes, and the rest of it, it's just, you know, myth, which, like you said, is often equated with falsehood?
Well, we've had such a political history. If you don't understand the political history or haven't delved into it, it can be kind of confusing. But the monotheistic traditions grew up as patriarchal traditions, and also the one God was a direct political statement against cultures that had many goddesses and gods and had a whole different way of conceptualizing how the cosmos worked. So right away, you're ending up with a political document that then is imbued with the word religion, and religion is imbued with connection with some super force that is totally in control, and that's usually called God. And so then you have your priests, and they come and they say they have a special relationship, or your other ministers in certain traditions, or it could be rabbis, whoever it is, they have a special relationship with that God, and they can then administer those laws. So if you don't understand all of that, sometimes it gets quite confusing. And they also will demonize or put off limits any other kind of information that might come from other cultures. So
well,
that's,
you know,
one of the
I remember
things.
It wasn't that long ago that conservative biblical scholars, like writing for archaeology magazines and stuff, they didn't even want to acknowledge God had a wife, you know,
yeah.
And Asherah, you know, was, you know, it's like they wanted to just totally turn a blind eye to the fact that the early Jews were polytheists, you know,
right.
As if they always just worshipped Yahweh.
Right.
And
that's a difficult,
you know, and I, you know, it's just like Christians who sometimes don't even know what the early Christianity was about. I think this is all so very interesting. That, like you said, the politics of it and the religion of it. You know, if you know, so many things. If it hadn't been translated the way it was, you just realize our society could have been so totally different if all those he's had maybe remained she's.
Yeah. Well, that's why the work that you're doing and I'm doing and all of your guests do in recovering and reinterpreting and presenting this material is really very important to the way our society operates. And it's my view that a lot of what we've done has been so effective that this is part of why we're getting such a strong reaction and we're getting such a political response to what we've been doing over the last 40 years. Because we have to remember that so much of this is only taken place in the intellectual life of this country in the last 40 years.
Right.
And pretty much since the mid-70s on, and increasingly so over the decades. So when we lose heart or get concerned about what's happening, I think we have to also acknowledge that we've done so much to open ourselves and others to a fresher and more encouraging worldview, and that that's really important to celebrate that. And not to become so overwhelmed by what we're experiencing right now, which,
well,
you know.
Well, you know, I think a good example of that, and I don't want to get too far afield, but I so loved that movie Avatar with all of its messages and its mother goddess and the balance idea and the connection with nature. And, it, you know, and thank you for James Cameron. I almost felt like he was a board, almost a goddess minister or something, you know, in the way that movie just affected so many people, you know, that they were so in tune with these ideas. I mean, look, the Pope was so disturbed he had to come out and make a statement that nature would never replace religion. So you know it must have had ramifications across the globe.
That's right. And I think that films and books and all kinds of creative enterprises are really making a big difference in what people are able to experience themselves. And so then that creates more tension, and we are going through this process of a shift.
Right.
And that
right.
that kind of leads me to why I thought that a myth, this was my own synthesis that came up that I've used for myself, is that Lilith, which is one of those demonized goddesses that comes from the Middle East and was originally a goddess and then became demonized, and I can tell you just a little bit of her background. She became such an important figure for me, and in the culture, the response that I've observed and heard is that still people are very ambivalent about Lilith because of all of the information that they can access about her demonizing nature. And really what Lilith was the great goddess in her nature image, and her beautiful naked body with the feet of a bird and the wings and the owls there. She's very connected with nature. And then she was brought in to be the first wife of Adam. And so that started to become an opportunity for them to make statements about an independent woman, because all that Lilith really was is the woman who wanted to be equal with her husband and did not want to be subservient. She didn't want to be put in a sexually subservient position. She wanted an equal relationship. That's all that's ever been said. And Adam wouldn't agree to that. So she took off, right?
And well, sort of like the spousification we were talking about in the first segment that happened to the Hindu goddesses.
Right, right. But she wouldn't agree to that.
Right.
And she was not going to give up her independent status. And I think that's also a political comment on probably what was going on at that particular time in history when there was these changeovers taking place in religion. And it was interesting that one of the things she did when she was leaving was that she uttered the name of God, and that was against Jewish law. And I've always wondered what was the name that she uttered, you know, because I'm not within that tradition, and I don't think that there's any problem with uttering the name of God, but it occurred to me that maybe she actually said the name of the goddess or the creatrix, that was really the truth of what it's all about. And
So she wasn't saying Yahweh. She was
maybe
saying the goddess, you know, Lilith.
I mean, that's
whatever.
Been my feeling, is that that's kind of the subtext of what was happening with this independent Lilith. So she left, and then Eve was brought in because Adam was still, he was lonely, he wanted a spouse, and she was brought in to be an adjunct to him. She did not have her own individual identity. She was supposed to just be, you know, part of him, serving him in whatever way that needed to be done. And still today, that's the real conflict we have going on, I think, in this culture, is what is going to be the parameter of a woman's life. And that's,
well, I mean, and you can see it in, you know, what's playing out just with abortion rights, that a
exactly.
woman is not autonomous,
right.
you know, that the baby in her womb trumps even her life,
right.
You know, to some people, or that women are so incapable of making these decisions for themselves.
Exactly. And that's the part that we are really engaged in right now, I think, when we're looking at this this conversation that's taking place in the Congress and the defunding of Planned Parenthood and so forth. But I was gonna make a few comments about that. But did you want to sort of finish the myth part, and that might be easier to do, or would you rather
jump? Yeah, but let's come back to this, because I want to talk a little bit more about the demonizing of Lilith, so we can dispel some of those horrible things about that they say about her. And I also wanted to ask you, because I heard that there was another book of Genesis, and so I just wondered if you knew anything about that. So, yeah, if you had something more you wanted to say about myth, and then we'll come back to Lilith.
Okay. Well, I think in myth, I've sort of given the overview that I wanted to set the stage with, which is that a myth is really a sacred story. And I think by telling these myths, that we're actually, and creating new ones that we tailor to our own needs and likings. See, I'm very much involved in the idea that you create something that works from your values and who you are, and you can interact with. You can use that kind of as one of your medicines in your medicine bag. And that really supports our mental health, especially through these periods when there's so many attacks and misinformation and taking place, that we need to have these myths that are empowering. And I think that pretty much gives my my kind of introduction to what mythology, how I view mythology and use it.
Well, and we can, and just to maybe punctuate what you've said, we see, especially in the case of women, we see how the myth has held women back, oppressed women, thwarted
right.
women to this very day. I mean, sometimes I think we're in the 19th century again, or something. It's incredible that we're having to refight the same battles, and you know, it seems like some, you know, things are getting more and more conservative, rather more and more enlightened.
Yeah, I think too. But what, you know, what's very strange about the political system, especially in the United States, it seems like there's ways in which these ideas can take over the governmental level
mm-hmm.
when they're not really in the population. There's
mm-hmm.
there's a different trend within the population, especially on cultural matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know if you remember, but like all during the '90s and even at the beginning of this current decade, it was all about how the liberal opinions had won the culture wars and that people were being more liberated. All the statistics show how people live their lives, their marriage statistics and people living in conventional manners has really declined. And yet you have this government now that wants to reinstate so many of the old attitudes. So it's one of the ways that our politics works in this country. And I think we need to stick close to our values, and we need to always live by those and express those in whatever way we can, because these things come and go, and we're in a period right now where we need to kind of stand with what we believe and connect with others that do, I think.
Right, and I think it's important, too, I say it all the time, and sometimes I get in trouble, but also to reconcile our spirituality with our politics, because for some people there's a real disconnect.
Yes, there certainly is, yeah.
You know, they want to say they're a feminist, but then they'll support conservative Republicans or something
is that
like
right?
that, you
is
know.
That right?
And
yeah.
And you know, when I find that, I my hair just goes on fire, you know, because I don't understand how they connect the dots in their head. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's for another conversation.
Yeah, that's a rough one to really try to figure out, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, quite honestly, it is. So just a little bit more on Lilith before we get to the Green Man. So all of these ideas about Lilith being the succubus, the killer of babies, I mean, that's all patriarchy propaganda, right?
Well, that's my view of it, but it's very deep and very historically entrenched. Currently, I really don't know if there's much of that that's being propagated. But certainly, historically, there was specifically in Jewish traditions, and it was the whole idea of Lilith coming and stealing children made women really afraid. And so they would put up amulets around their children's beds and develop this whole fear of some female entity out there, which psychologically is really, I would think, debilitating to an individual woman, or it certainly divides up women between those that are like Lilith and those that are not going to be like Lilith and are going to support the patriarchy. So that, I think, was a very, very intentional thing that was done, and to keep women from being empowered, because when you have a demonized female figure in a monotheism, that's quite disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also the other aspect of Lilith is that she goes after single men and sexually excites them in the night. She's like a night entity, and so that again ties back to how women are viewed in patriarchy and how we have a lot of demonization of anything sexual that a woman
yeah.
might express.
She's the temptress, the evil temptress, rather
right.
than having a healthy sexuality outlook.
Right, and that was really prominent also in the end of the 19th century. You were mentioning that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the art and different trends, there was a heavy involvement with a Lilith figure that was very strange, and it was kind of the backdrop of the Victorian period.
Mm-hmm.
So Lilith made that resurgence again as this kind of demonizing and frightening individual entity, which carries over in this culture, so that women generally have that kind of aura around them that they have to deal with in some way. And I think we're still dealing with that image in the current politics and in the current ways in which women are able to express themselves.
And might that also play into why some women are in burqas?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. Because one of the things that I've heard about the covering is, in addition to you're not allowed to be seen by anybody that's not in your family, you're not allowed to, a woman cannot be seen by anybody but her husband and her brothers and so forth, I think is what in some of the conservative beliefs around why you wear a burqa when you go outside. But it's also about the sexuality of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping that. And also I've heard women say that they feel that it protects them in public and they're not accosted and so forth. So that's something about what the culture is like for women.
So, or maybe, well, someone had said, what is it when you're sort of brainwashed by your captors? What is that syndrome?
Yeah, the Stockholm Syndrome.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
That maybe that's really what they're projecting and they don't even realize it.
I think we get that a lot in the current climate for a lot of women.
Right. Well, now just quickly, and then we'll get on to the Green Man. I think I recall that the story of the Garden of Eden, that at one point Adam and Eve, in one book that of course didn't make the Bible, they were created simultaneously rather than Eve comes from Adam's body as if male gives birth. You know.
Yeah.
So is that accurate? I mean, do you happen to know if that's the truth?
Well, you know, I have a source that is similar to that I was going to share if I had a chance, and maybe this is a good time to do it. There's a magazine that some Jewish feminists created starting about 40 years ago called Lilith, and their purpose was to reframe the story and to be an outlet to share empowering elements from Judaism and also to reframe anything that wasn't. And one of the things that they quoted in their masthead was that this little phrase that says, according to myth and legend, Lilith was the first woman created before Eve. She was Adam's absolute equal. In the Garden of Eden, long before the eating of the apple, the Holy One created the first human beings, a man named Adam and a woman named Lilith. Lilith said, we are equal because we are created from the same earth. And that supposedly comes from a medieval text called Alphabet of the Ben Sira. So I thought that was kind of relevant to what you were saying. Whether or not that was actually in any of the early books of the Bible, I don't know, because I haven't really tracked it. But they used that as their frame for what they were creating around reclaiming Lilith. So, yes, they saw them as created from the same earth as being and being equal.
And so was there more you wanted to say about Lilith before we go on to the Green Man, or have we covered her?
Well, I think we've covered her enough to kind of set up what the story is there, because I think when I say Lilith meets the Green Man, I'm talking about Lilith, the free woman, the one that embodies the great goddess, the one that is in complete control and feels empowered by her sexuality in a way that she can express it in a constructive way and can make her own decisions about what she wants to do sexually. So that's the Lilith that I'm talking about when I talk about Lilith meets the Green Man.
Okay. And now when you say the Green Man, who do you mean?
Okay. Well, the Green Man is an image that is actually quite prevalent all across Europe and in the British Isles in a lot of the public spaces. And it's a face of a man with foliage surrounding it. And often this face will appear on cathedrals and in other places that are considered holy. And it's been rediscovered, and it's similar to the Sheila Na Gigs when Laura was saying that somebody said they wouldn't have even noticed it if they hadn't had it pointed out. And that was happening, I think, a lot with these green men until the last, again, 30 years, when so much research has been done and interest in this. And this image was brought to the fore. So there's a whole movement of people who have been telling the story of the green man. which is in some places called the archetype of oneness with the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And he's definitely related, in my view, to the god Pan, the ecstatic god who brought the merriment to the crowds in need of cheering, and he's very embedded in the earth. And a lot of times we will feminize the earth and we'll say the earth, she. But this is one image that can actually tie the masculine or the male to the earth and pull that what men can aspire to out of just the disconnection and abstraction and back into being integrated in a natural system. And I think that's why I've always been drawn to the green man, because it gives us a new way of looking at what's possible for men, and how a lot of men have actually benefited from being able to have this kind of image and work with it. And one of the people that I was particularly interested in who had picked it up was Matthew Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And he's written a book in the last few years called The Hidden Spirituality of Men.
Mm-hmm.
And for those that maybe don't know who Matthew Fox is, he was a Roman Catholic Dominican Order priest for about 34 years, but he was always promoting a theology that was much friendlier to earth-based spirituality and much friendlier to equality of women and so forth. And he got in trouble with the Vatican, and he was silenced.
Ended up excommunicated.
Yeah, he was eventually excommunicated, and then he went into a period of silence to decide. They said he couldn't speak anymore, and he finally decided that he was going to speak, and then he left. He was excommunicated, and he's now, I think, an Episcopal priest. And he's done a lot of writing on various topics, but he did pick up on the Green Man, and I thought it was interesting because he gave the background. The Green Man is ancient, and he's shown himself 5,000 years ago in Neolithic art in Central Europe. So there's always been this image, even though we're more familiar with the ones on the cathedrals now.
Mm-hmm.
And the Green Man images in Celtic art predate the Roman conquest of Gaul, so they've been around for a long time.
Also makes me think of Osiris.
Yeah.
You know, because he's the green growing earth as well.
Right, right. And it ties into that. And also the idea that Fox came up with was that the Green Man relates to the divine feminine and the Great Mother, and actually stands for the internalization of the goddess by men, is how he had come to understand it. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, he's got some interesting work out there on new archetypes men can embrace to not be the warrior aggressor, you know.
Right. And I think part of the God, just part of the Green Man for him, and this resonates for me, is the idea of love over brute force, that's
mm-hmm.
really what we're looking for. And now we have this brute force image of masculinity.
Right.
So I see the Green Man as a very different type of male.
Right, right. I can totally see that. And he was on the show. If people, listeners, want to look back in the archives, they actually can find him. I love all the rebels. They're the ones I want to interview.
rebels become your beginning quote on the show, I think, is very applicable, where you talk about what rebels eventually it becomes the way people look
truth.
At things, right? Isn't that the
yeah.
truth? And we just have to be able to outlast all the other, stages. Huh?
Tenacity. Yeah. I, some of the women I know, we say we are water wearing away rock.
That's right. That's right. And I think that whole celebration of who we are, that's what I wanted to get to through this whole myth, was that when these archetypes meet each other, it's kind of like a part of us also meets within us. So if you're at all predisposed to Jungian psychology or anything about how you might within yourself carry these elements, then your Lilith and your Green Man can meet together, and you have a very strong whole from which to work. And
whether you're a man or a woman, too. I don't think the gender matters.
Right, exactly. And I think because we have this whole other myth, which is the counterpoint to this, which is the Garden of Eden myth, this Lilith meets the Green Man will take and embrace some of those demonized elements of that myth and actually make them powerful.
Mm-hmm. Make them more authentic and true and useful to us rather than this distorted view that we've been brainwashed with.
Yeah, and I think, too, when you see that images that are important or symbols that are important have been demonized, you have to look a little deeper and think, well, maybe they were actually sacred symbols
in
another system. And so if we know that, then we can make more sense out of what the symbols mean. And the symbols of the snake and the tree and the apple are so central to the Garden of Eden myth, the patriarchal myth. But they are actually so important.
Well, let's make sure we talk about that. I just wanted to give you a heads up. We have about 19 minutes.
Okay.
And I know we still have other things to cover. So let's jump into that symbolism, if you would, Liz.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Well, those three images perplexed me because as I was doing research in various traditions, the snake and the tree really jumped out as being sacred. And here I had heard about them all through my childhood, everybody does, about how they were the ones that caused all the trouble,
mm-hmm.
and the snake being in the tree. And so when I looked into it a little bit further, it's the snake, and a lot of us know this because if you do any kind of cross-cultural research, you'll come across the snake as an ancient symbol of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and the snake was really close to the ground, and so it picked up the earth energy, and it could
mm-hmm.
give you the knowledge
mm-hmm.
of how the world worked.
Mm-hmm.
And in ancient traditions, and even up until today, in folk traditions, you'll find snakes embroidered on clothing and on pottery and so forth. It's considered a very positive, healing energy. You see it in medicine. You see it on the various medical staffs. And so
mm-hmm.
forth, even
yeah,
in our own medical traditions, right?
Right, right.
So when you look at a snake and say, "Oh, well, this is a terrible demon," and often that snake, in some of the mythology, will actually be connected with a woman's face. So it's actually considered to be Lilith in some of the art that I've looked at, and so forth. So the snake itself, we have to get into that a little bit deeper so that we can reclaim that snake and understand that wisdom as we look through all the mythology and the symbolism. And the tree itself, too, is often considered to be like the tree of life, and that has all of this energy connected with how a tree works by having its roots in the ground and then having its branches in the air, and it connects heaven and earth, and it has a lot of very protective and important connotations in earth-based spirituality. So you have the snake and you have the tree, and the snake, again, also is connected with the Kundalini force that's in each of us. And that's kind of our life force, and whether that life force can be activated and brought up in our being so we can be fully embodied. And it's my view that when we demonize the snake and we demonize the tree, we're actually preventing people from having imagery that can allow them to be totally embodying their own spirit. And so it's really important to reclaim those images and put them in a positive framework, and then that allows people to actually understand what it is to be fully alive and spiritual because they're actually encompassing them in their own bodies and opening
mm-hmm.
their chakras and so forth. So for me, incorporating those into a myth about a free woman and an earth-honoring man, and they relate to the snake and the tree in a very positive way. And then the last image that is so important, and you use this as one of your trademarks, is the apple.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can tell me how you respond to the apple. I was always wondering how
well,
that spoke to you.
I look at all of these symbols as representations of the goddess, you know, the serpent.
Yes.
The goddess was all, you know, in early times, you know, a lot of them were trees, you know, Asherah, Artemis, and
right.
the apple. I mean, I know that's associated with Aphrodite to a certain
right.
extent. You cut it open, it's got the pentagram in it.
Right.
So for me, they've always been, you know, goddess symbols. But it's like the symbol I use for the radio show, it's taste the forbidden fruit, the thing the patriarchy doesn't want you to know, doesn't want you to have a taste of. That's sort of what the apple represents. It's the hidden knowledge, the mysteries that's been kept from women, for centuries.
Yeah, and I think that there's an intertwining of that with it being an ancient love symbol and a wisdom symbol, the apple, because
mm-hmm.
you say like it's all connected with the goddess, but if the goddess, you go back and you say, well, Lilith is this free woman who should be able to express her own spirituality and her own sexuality and see how those are connected, And as Laura said about her Indian goddesses, it's also about how sexuality and creativity are interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of the forbidden knowledge that you
mm-hmm.
that you're talking about. And so the apple represents that. And the apple in many ancient stories is about love, is about how we can feel love. Because in this culture, I feel like patriarchy tries to divide people from
mm-hmm.
having that experience of love, of you know, of on all levels. It's something that's very dangerous to a hierarchical system. And so with these images, if you think about them and you have different connections to them, they can just be instantaneously empowering, it would seem to me.
Well, yeah, you think about, like you said, patriarchy is always creating the wedge issues, because if the Tibet people weren't mad with liberals, we might all get together and throw these bums out of Congress, wouldn't we?
Right. Right, and I think it goes back, too, to the whole idea of what's happened now with the, I don't know if you want to go on yet or not, but I was just thinking that we, I wanted to talk a little bit about what was happening in the culture as far as
go ahead.
Some of these political moves that are taking place, like the defunding of Planned Parenthood. And I think that really relates back to what we've been talking about. And it's kind of a direct comment on women who have, and many, many women, and the images of women in the popular culture is much more liberated. And this, what they're, the kind of rhetoric they're using to justify this this defunding is really, like you say, 19th century rhetoric
mm-hmm.
about how women can't really handle their own sexuality, that they have to be protected from that, that if they have contraception, then they'll be promiscuous, and they will, they'll also decide that they're going to prevent themselves from conceiving, and therefore they will hurt themselves and not experience reproduction. So all of these things are being said as justification, and I think it's important for us to realize that we need to have our understandings put out there that are different than that. And we've done a very good job of this all these years. Even the idea of a name called Planned Parenthood, what a revolutionary thing that was when it first came in, because if you go back just to the 60s, we didn't have these kinds of things very readily available. Birth control didn't become readily available until the early 60s, because back in the 1860s or so, there was a man named Comstock who was a radical conservative who said we're not going to have any birth control. And so there were all of these people who, all these women who got pregnant and had many, many children, and many women died in childbirth, and all of this went on, and it was a lot of people had, Margaret Sanger and others had to really work hard to challenge this blocking of contraception. And I think that we should take this as a serious matter and try to really understand what the historical story is, and also what the present day implications of all of this is.
Yeah, because it's oppression veiled as something else, as something
yes.
that's good for us.
Yes.
It's like when I was reading the evangelicals talk about the new feminism. You know, they try to make it look like, oh, it's just about elevating and uplifting and honoring the woman, where if you really read between the lines, it's about making her dependent. They talk about divorce, grounds for divorce, or abandonment, or adultery, but not abuse. I mean,
yeah,
what kind of a message
right?
does that send?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, well, one of the
go ahead.
One of the problems is that they again are returning. A lot of this is going back to the 19th century, because in the 19th century there was this whole idea that women were spiritually and morally superior, and because they didn't engage in the public sphere, they stayed at home, and they didn't concern themselves with politics, and they just did certain things that made them morally superior.
Ooh, Madonnas.
Yeah, and so that's what they're playing off of, is when you have it's not that easy sometimes for women to participate in the public sphere, especially when you are your opportunities are really limited or less than men. So a lot of women are not that anxious to go out and get a job or be out in the culture. So they can play off of these fears, and
mm-hmm.
they can also play off of the idea that, well, we're really honoring you by keeping you on this pedestal, quote unquote,
right.
and separated from the world. And this is something that I personally don't understand how they're able to put these things forward in the current economy and the current lifestyles that people are living, but they seem to have appealed to a certain element that supports that. And I'm not sure, you know, how that happens, but we have to keep our images alive and fresh and interesting, I think, in order for that not to become so confusing that people just pull away from the whole conversation.
Right, right. Well, Liz, let me ask you, do you think this is just we're refighting the old battles again, or do you think this is the last gasps of the patriarchy, you know, giving us their, you know, their last best fight before they die?
I think it's I think it's more and more a last best fight if we can continue our work without being distracted by some of the most egregious comments and attacks that we receive, because there's always among sensitive people, and most of the people who engage in some kind of practices that are not patriarchal are sensitive, so there's always this tendency to pull back when you're attacked. You don't want to be out there fighting and screaming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to come up with some other ways also of projecting ourselves, which I think we are doing well and need to continue doing that, and incorporate the celebration in all of our practices and the humor. And by humor, I don't mean just our critiques and our satire, which is also very important, but also the humor that really lifts our energy and gets us away from some of the day-to-day things that can really pull us down in this struggle with patriarchy.
Like Balbo.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, and the kind of just celebrations that we can have, music. One of the things that I think was really effective was the Lilith Fair presentations. If you I don't know if you followed that, but the rock stars had the female rock stars put on these series, and they were really big in 1997 and through 99, and then they were revived last year, where they performed around the country, and there were primarily bands that had women rock stars in them, and they were very much making the point that they were reclaiming Lilith, and that mm-hmm. they were. Sarah McLachlan was one of the people that was organizing this, and she wrote a book and promoted the idea that that Lilith was a courageous woman, courageous image, and she, and because of that, she fell out of favor with men in her life, and so she wanted to honor her with this whole event, and it reached a lot of young women, and it was all this music and celebration. So I think that was one of the things that was breaking through the consciousness, and I'm particularly interested in young women because I think that these women are facing these issues, and they're not going to want to go back. A lot of them are not going to want to go back into some kind of a repressive situation that many of us came out of in the 50s
right.
and 60s. They're not going to want to go back to that. So I think as we encourage and support these new images, we can get them involved and speaking out on this stuff. And so that's one of the things that I'm also interested in when they have new myths, like Lilith meets the Green Man. They have a celebration. They can relate differently to each other. I think that's the other piece of this that we need to explore, is how can relationships between men and women shift so that we can have a new paradigm in
mm-hmm.
our relationships. And we'd worked on that quite a bit. And, of course, there's always tensions and difficulties in the process of change and evolution. But I think that's something to continue to hold up.
Yeah, that balance between the divine feminine and sacred masculine.
And redefining both of them. Like a lot of times we talk about the sacred masculine, and we don't remember that most people have a different view of what masculine is than what we might be talking about.
Yeah,
and
we're talking
Earth-honor.
More like the Matthew Fox sort of
right.
new ideas of masculine, as opposed to the patriarchal Yahweh, authoritarian father masculine.
Right, and you also have, because you can have the nurturing male, you can have the male that is into cooperation, or, you know, and they'll say, oh, well, that's feminizing the male. But there isn't a whole lot of psychological proof that men have to be disconnected from their nurturing selves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of evidence that there's quite a bit of desire to do that kind of nurturing with the different forms of different ways in which men are interacting with their children, or they're
mm-hmm.
interacting with things they do that are not traditional masculine activities, and so forth. So encouraging that is just as much a part, I think, of the goddess energy as anything else if we're going to see a shift.
Right. Well, and the male can become the protector instead of the aggressor. That's another thing I think I maybe heard from Matthew Fox or maybe one of the other gentlemen I've had on the show. One called it men have to develop their ascendant. Women have to develop their ascendant male, and men have to develop their ascendant female. And it basically was the same terminology for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
I would also comment too that in my experience, sometimes we get a little too gender typed. Sometimes I think where I think there's a wider range in each gender than we may have acknowledged, because under patriarchy there's such a need to tie qualities to gender.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
if we were allowed to just put that aside for a little while, we would see a lot of variety within each gender as to what their preferred style of action might be, within a range that's still in the larger value system, but the range might be broader, if you know what I mean.
Well, and I wonder if that's why patriarchy or conservatives have such a problem with the gay community.
Yes.
Because they're not living in that little box.
Yeah. And they also have this whole series of repressive activities and attitudes that take place in their own communities that cause them to have a lot of attitudes about things that they may not have if they hadn't had that kind of background.
Right.
You know, whether they're repressing, you know, there's so many people who come out of the conservative world who actually are gay or have gay tendencies.
But they've been repressed.
Yeah, or they feel they need to repress them because they have this attitude that they're wrong, and so
they're an abomination, remember?
Right, they're an abomination, but so what does that do to you as an individual?
It destroys
you know, and something that should be just neutral, whatever, it should just be
mm-hmm.
a choice, a way
well,
in which you
act. Well, look at the suicides, you know,
yeah.
Look at the suicides. Well, Liz, we probably have about 2 minutes left, and this has been so insightful. I want to thank you, but I want to give you a chance for just a little wrap-up. Was there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to leave listeners with, you know, any thoughts?
Well, I think I mentioned a number of things, and I think I just want to reiterate that for me, it's important in our lives to coordinate the mythological and our political and social lives, and feel that we can speak out on political issues or engage them, but we have our mythology to support us in that effort, and also that the joy in life is really an important part of the whole equation here, that we can get really bogged down in some of the current politics, and it's coming at us so quickly that it's hard to not go into that fight or flight method
mm-hmm.
of being sometimes in your own feelings and
mm-hmm.
the fear that you can feel from this onslaught. You talked about that a little earlier, and I think that's a real danger when we're having this kind of situation going on. But one of the antidotes that I think is to have that image of celebration and community and being in this egalitarian relationship and being able to embody all of our creativity and all of this energy that's available to each person, that's their birthright, that we claim that and connect with others that can claim that and kind of spread that circle, keep spreading that circle out and inviting others into that circle.
Right.
So that they can get relief from this conflict zone that seems
right,
to
the
be
onslaught.
That seems to be everywhere. So, you know, you can just do it in a little meditation. When you're at a demonstration, you can do a meditation. And sometimes at the demonstrations, people will come with drums and kind of that kind of excitement that is like an ecstatic energy that we often find in celebrations in communities that do that sort of thing. So I would leave that with people, is to keep that celebration and that joy going at the same time that we're very razor clear about what's happening and we don't put up with it.
Okay. Well, we're about ready to go off the air. I want to leave your website just in case people want to get in touch with you, Liz. It's riseupandcallhername.com.
That's right.
Listeners, please go ahead to that website, look at the curriculum, look at Liz's work there, and can they also email you if they want to?
Oh, yes, absolutely, anytime. That's fine.
Okay.
There's an email on there. It's just Liz Fisher at wiseupandcallhername.com.
Okay.
And I'd hear any comments or engage in any conversations about all of this.
Well, Liz, thank you so much. It's been delightful.
Thank you, Karen.
And when you come up with another show topic as interesting as this, you let me know and you'll be back on the show.
All right. Well, it was always great to talk to you, and I appreciate all that you're doing.
Well, same here. We're all just doing what we feel called to do.
That's right. Well, good thing that you're called.
All right. Well, good night, Liz, and
night.
Thank you for your time and for your work out there in the world. And listeners, as we say good night for another week, I just want to remind you that my guest next Wednesday is going to be Gary Bobroff and K.D. Farris. We're going to be talking about archetypal identity and how we can recognize the archetypes that lie behind what motivates us and provides us our greatest satisfaction in the world. Also, we can recognize the archetypes at work motivating others. So please join us again next week. Thank you for being a part of the Voices of the Sacred Family, Sacred Feminine Family, and hang in there with your goddess ideals. Be her sacred roar. Good night, listeners.